We're going to open our Rules Committee hearing, and we have a number of legislators here that need to get onto their different things. So the first one, we're going to open just a public hearing on House Bill 3004A. And with that, we're going to invite Representative Clem to come up and talk about some amendments. This bill is going to be carried over today, so he just wanted to take a moment to explain amendments that we're waiting on this bill. And then we'll close that hearing and move on. Oh, watch out for sitting down. You might hurt your leg. So.
Welcome to the committee.
Is Mike's bad?
You ready?
Hello? Testing?
Yeah. They can hear in the back. Yeah.
All right, then.
When you talk into it.
Thank you, Mr. Principal. I mean, Mr. Chair. This is Brian Clem, State Representative, House District 21 here in Central and East Salem. House Bill 3004A came to you out of the Consumer Protection Committee, and we've got some amendments that are being drafted. I inadvertently captured a piece in the bill that had to do with refinancing, and that part needs to come out. And then we've got an agreement with this is really an extraordinary opportunity for the state, but we've got an agreement with the financial community to really provide both a fix to a loophole in the law and also some retroactive relief for consumers who are in really serious shape right now. They've lost their homes to foreclosure, and they've got a lender that out-of-state lender that is trying to basically take debt from them that was created from a loophole in the law, and our financial community and the Consumer Protection Committee we're working together on trying to figure out how to do it, and these amendments should get us there to where everybody can move forward on helping these Oregonians who are in a lot of trouble. Many of them live in Representative Edwards' district, and the parents of one of them live in my district, Jane Cummins. She came and talked to me about the bill. We introduced it. And then the Consumer Protection Committee got us this far, and there's one more little amendment needed to get the refinancing language out and the retroactivity language in. Yeah.
Mr. Chair?
Any questions? Yes, Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you so much for bringing this bill. We talked the other day, and it sounds very important. When we talked, you referenced the number of people that this has the potential to help retroactively. Could you tell us a little bit about the scope of the impact this is going to have on Oregonians?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Gelser, what we know of is the parent of, he's also an attorney for a kind of a larger insurance plan that a lot of companies in Oregon subscribe to for prepaid legal services. He's aware of roughly 60 folks in the same circumstance who've been foreclosed on, and because of a loophole in the law, they're being still trying to attempt to collect debt on the house that otherwise would never be available, on an average between $20,000 and $50,000. So just for those 60, just in that one law firm, that's between $1.2 and $3 million worth of debt that could conceivably be forgiven, that should never have been owed in the first place by these consumers, just in one law firm.
Thank you. It's a good bill.
Further questions? Seeing none, thank you very much. We're going to close this public hearing and work session, and just public hearing, and we're going to move this bill to Monday or Wednesday. We'll see how that goes. We have a lot of stuff on the schedule on Monday, so thank you with that. Next, we're going to go to open a work session on House Bill 3487, and we're going to have our Representative Boone up and have a short explanation by our administrator.
Thank you, Chair Roblin. Members of the committee, House Bill 3487 modifies the definition of child care facility in ORS 257A-250 to include preschool facility, modifies the exclusion from the definition of child care facility for facility providing care that is primarily educational. Previous sessions, you discussed the importance of criminal background checks for persons working with preschool-aged children and the fiscal impact of the proposal. You have before you a -1 amendment. And the proposed House Bill 3487-1 amendment replaces the original bill. It modifies the definition of a child care facility in ORS 657.A.250 by providing an express but limited exclusion for a preschool recorded program. Defines a preschool recorded program to mean a facility providing care for preschool children that is primarily educational and where no child is present at the facility for more than 4 hours a day. Requires a person operating a preschool recorded program to record the program with the Child Care Division of the Employment Department and pay a recording fee. It directs the Child Care Division to issue a record if the applicant meets the requirements of ORS 657A.250 to 657A.450 and specified administrative rules. Requires a person operating a preschool recorded program to perform criminal background checks for all staff and volunteers, and adds the operator of a preschool recorded program to the list of mandatory child abuse reporters.
Do we have this bill?
We do have the fiscal and the revenue.
On the dash ones?
On the dash ones, but what I'm looking for is my note. Yes, we have a zero fiscal and a minimal fiscal and a zero revenue impact statement. And I want to verify that we've got the hard copy right here.
And with that, talk to the dash ones one more time for us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Deborah Boone, House District 32, and I've taken the liberty of inviting my good friend Tom Olson up here. In case you have any tough questions, he gets those. I get the mush balls, as my good senator tells me. Jerry did a great job of explaining what this bill does. The amendment is this does gut and stuff the original or the other bill. The bill that this started out to be has a large amount of our colleagues signed on to it, and I believe that's the purpose of why they signed on. So I'll try to round them up as we change this bill into that. But this captures a group of children who were being cared for by a group that did not have oversight in any way, shape, or form, and we felt that was important, that at least they be known to the state if they're going to take money for a service like this, and so our children can be protected. I'll stop there if anybody has any questions.
Any questions? I think we got most of them answered last week, so thank you very much. I'll take, we are in a work session, I would take a motion.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the dash one amendment dated 5-13-09 to House Bill 3487.
Representative Edwards moves to adopt the dash one amendments to House Bill 3487. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3487 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Edwards moves House Bill 3487 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, we'll take a roll call vote.
Representative Gerard?
Aye.
Representative Belzer?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Excused.
Representative Nolan?
Excused.
Representative Reed?
Aye.
Vice Chair Berger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Edwards?
Aye.
Chair Roland?
Aye.
Motion passes.
Representative, would you care to carry this bill?
I would be honored.
Okay. Representative Boone to carry. We're going to close our work session on House Bill 3487. And we're going to open a work session on 2345. Do we have all the amendments?
I think we probably got Jefferson.
Okay.
Okay.
Okay, we're going to open a work session on House Bill 2345A. So we'll have a short explanation from our administrator on 2345A. 2345A, I just opened.
Oh, you won?
Yeah.
Chair Roberman, thank you. Members of the committee, House Bill 2345A requires that health professional licensing boards develop a process to deal with impaired professionals, establishes uniform standards for monitoring impaired professionals, requires the licensee to report any arrest or conviction of misdemeanor or felony crime to the program within one business day after the licensee is arrested or convicted. Requires the licensee to report any arrest or conviction prior to the program within one business day after the licensee is arrested or convicted, directs healthcare professional licensing boards to impose sanctions on impaired professionals, deletes existing impaired professional programs of specific boards, applies to licensees identified by health professional licensing boards and disciplinary proceedings commenced on or after January 1, 2010, declares an emergency effective on passage. You previously discussed proposed amendments, concerns about privacy issues, and the maintenance of personal information. The amendment that you have before you, 2345A-7, deletes the proposed requirement for licensees to consent to the entry of their name and fingerprints in the law enforcement data system, substitutes a requirement for the licensee to self-report or arrest or a conviction of misdemeanor or felony crimes to the program within one business day after the licensee is arrested or convicted. That's it.
First, with a short discussion in our work session, this is the one that Representative Maurer came and testified on, and I think it was the Dash 7s that he said if we put in and other people were okay with. Anybody? Okay. So, and it goes, does this have a subsequent referral or not?
This yes. does not on yes. the agenda, does not have a subsequent okay. referral on the amendment.
I just want to make sure we have all the
does
paperwork.
Does not have a subsequent referral. However, yeah. I'm not positive that we have the fields.
That's what I was wondering.
I'd like to keep it open. Can we keep it open while we check on that?
Yes. Maybe. So we're not quite sure if we have
the fiscal.
So I thought we had it, and we'll check on that one. And we'll open. We'll leave this one open while we check and make sure. And representatives. Oh, you have it. Okay.
Seven.
And it's okay, right? It says.
Well, it's another one of those. It's
the minimum.
Yep.
So, with that, I'll make a motion.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 7 amendments to House Bill 2345A.
Representative Berger moves the Dash 7 amendments to 23, I'll get the right number, 45A. Is there any discussion? Yes.
Thank you. I think this is an important bill, and I know that a lot of work has gone into it. I just want to put on the record some discomfort that I have knowing that we are sending out a bill that still needs a lot of work across the floor and to the Senate. We talked about that the other day. I know that time is tight, and if it has a chance of moving, we do need to move it over to the Senate, but I'm hopeful that there can be some direct follow-up with the chair of the committee who receives this bill to understand that we still have some concerns and we're moving it forward in the interest of time and further work.
I agree. I appreciate that very much. Any other discussion? This is on the amendment, so is there any objection to the amendment? So ordered, Representative Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move House Bill 2345A as amended today to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Berger moves House Bill 2345A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, we'll take a roll call vote.
Representative Berard?
Aye.
Representative Gelser?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Excused.
Representative Nolan?
Excused.
Representative Reed?
Aye.
Vice Chair Berger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Edwards?
Aye.
Chair Roland?
Aye. It passes, and we'll let Representative Maurer carry this bill. Because I think the rest of us don't have as good an understanding.
Right. It's his bill.
It's his bill. With that, what were the two that Jefferson?
These two, 34 and 93.
We're going to open public hearings on 3488, and I'm going to open a public hearing on 3490. We'll have short explanations by our administrator on both, and representative, you may take a seat if it's a chance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jefferson Smith, House representatives representing District 47. These closely linked bills, one on a redistricting advisory committee and the other on agricultural theft, because of their close conceptual linkage, I appreciate the committee hearing them together. First, I will address redistricting and House Bill 3488. Redistricting is coming up in conversation and in various minds, including mine, will be coming up in reality relatively soon. And I think others, thought about offering a proposal or signing on to one with a specific redistricting proposal. My challenge with that, as I thought about it, discussed it with others, was that it was impossible for me and for them to view any specific redistricting proposal outside the context of the coming two elections, the census, and the redistricting. And in discussing and thinking about it, I was reminded of my political science courses and John Rawls and the Veil of Ignorance, that when we make a decision, we should try to make that decision whenever possible, as if we are behind a veil of ignorance, not knowing what position we will be in. And in no conversation about any specific proposal I might bring about redistricting, could we remove our own political calculations of the coming elections and the coming redistricting. Moreover, I thought about how my dad used to split up pie in my household, which when we only had one piece of pie left, and when I was a child, we were only ever allowed in our household to have one piece of pie, there was my brother and I fighting over the pie, and my dad would present the piece of pie and say, one of you cuts, the other chooses. Right? So that I knew that one of us would then be required to cut it relatively fairly or to create a very, very strange shape to try to fool our brother. And it seemed to me that we should keep the lessons in mind, maybe not of pie, but at least of the veil of ignorance, to allow the state to consider how we redistrict, particularly outside the context of the coming political debates. How should we redistrict? Should we keep the system we have or should we change it? If we change it, how should we change it? Is it good to try to squeeze out some of the politics from the practice? Is that even possible? If we do that, and if it is good, does it merely squeeze it to somewhere more secret? What are the best models around the country? How could we improve upon those best models? It seemed like these questions were important enough to do and do right. And I fear, and this would enact advisory council to do it and consider it after the next redistricting, which might seem strange, but what I worry about is in the political shuffle, we won't be able to trust too many proposals that come up in the next 2 years, and then after that we'll think it's done and we'll never need to do it. And if we do think we should address redistricting, the best time to do it might be while the lessons are in our minds, but the political analysis will be several years in the offing, and we can make the best decision in terms of governance rather than our calculation of who will be made better off. So this, I don't expect this is a bill that we will be pushing to get out this session. If other people have different feelings, that would, of course, be wonderful. But do want to put it out there in the chance that it becomes more and more relevant as we go forward. Happy to answer questions if people want to ask them, or I can stop.
Any questions? Representative Girard.
Representative Smith, how's the Secretary of State with this?
I must admit, I did discuss... I started a discussion with the Secretary of State's office about particular proposals. I think it is fair to say that she was skeptical about any particular proposal I might have mentioned, with good reasons, right? With good arguments, and not just the political calculation argument I gave. So and I mentioned that I was doing this. She neither assented or dissented, and before we move forward, for sure we'd want to connect with the Secretary of State's office, I think.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Is there anyone else that would like to testify for this bill? Because currently there's no one else on the list. If not, then that was House Bill 3488. Mm-hmm. So we're going to close our public hearing on 3488. And we still have open House Bill 3490.
The related bill.
Yeah, the related bill. Well, let's give a short explanation first.
Friday rules. Go ahead.
a second. Okay. Thank you, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. House Bill 3490 modifies theft in the first degree to include theft of agricultural property valued at $100 or more and committed on property granted farm use special assessment under certain additional circumstances. Proponents assert that theft of agricultural property by persons who commit criminal trespass and cause property damage is a significant problem and deserves first-degree treatment.
Thank you very much. And you were going to say about rules on Friday afternoon?
Oh, it's not. It's sort of like last day of school, right? There's a lot of people here, but everybody's just waiting to go home, right?
That may not be restricted to Friday.
Right. So the again, for the record, Jefferson Smith, representing District 47 in the State House, here to testify on House Bill 3490 with regard to agricultural theft. The problem statement essentially, and put quickly, owner of agricultural property, non-livestock, gets trespassed upon, suffers damage to their property, truck damages ground, uproots tree, further damage to ground, busts a fence, gets a product stolen of value under $1,000. What that amounts to is three lesser crimes that are rarely prosecuted. For sure rarely caught, and even when caught, too often not prosecuted. This results in under-deterrence. We have under-deterrence in part because when you have non-livestock or even livestock, agricultural property, it is very often far afield from a security camera or nearby watching neighbors or a police department on the corner, etc. The theory of deterrence is that we want to smack people hard enough so that even if only one person gets smacked, that might have an impact on 100 people or 10 people or 5 people doing something. Here we smack so few times, and the smack we offer is so light that I think that the proponents of this bill have a legitimate beef. We already, in burglary, theft inside a dwelling, apply theft one. Theft of livestock also is theft one. A piece of agricultural land is not a dwelling, and a $80 Japanese maple is not a $150 year-old heifer. But there does seem still to be something here. There is some sanctity of property, particularly if that property is damaged, or with livestock and pets. Also, with regard to the livestock, one rationale for why livestock valued under $1,000 is still theft one is partly the sanctity of the property and partly because that value of that property could be increased, as one might have with a nursery tree that is of certain value now but over time will be of greater value after you've carted away in your truck. There are some caveats to this. There may be a fiscal impact which might slow us or stop us. The LC wrote $100 and I believe the agreed upon amount was $150, like a year-old heifer or like two Japanese maples. Or like a truckload of other cheaper agricultural products. But ultimately what the bill does is three things. If you trespass the land and damage the property and steal agricultural property valued over, right now, $100, but I believe the intended amount was $150, that would be theft one. There will be questions about, well, how might this apply not only in rural areas, but in urban areas. What happens if I break into a backyard and steal something from there? And I think that's a valuable conversation as well. But I think this is a valuable conversation for the committee to have, and I appreciate your hearing it today.
Representative Garrard.
I'm still trying to figure out the relating clause to redistricting, but I'm working on that. Representative, thank you for bringing this bill forward. I hope the chair will continue to move the bill. It's a good one, and thank you. But he didn't hear a word I said.
I don't know if you heard a word I said either, but we agree.
Well,
I got one.
Representative Edwards, did you have a question?
No.
Okay. Any other questions for Representative Smith? Thank you. We have three other witnesses or so.
Thanks very much, members of the committee. Have a good weekend.
So we might as well finish this. So Sean Cleave.
He's not staying?
Yeah, Josh? He's probably going to stay and listen to this other. Sean Cleave, Josh Zielinski, and Kathy Lee Klempiet from the tree farm. Actually, bring four. Jeff, you can come on up to him and just pull a chair if you want.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sean Cleave, representing the Oregon Farm Bureau, testifying today in support of House Bill 3490, the Ag Theft Bill. I won't belabor the committee with a rehashing of Rep. Smith's eloquent description of the problem. We spoke to many of you over the last couple of days regarding the bill. It is an issue of enforcement. I have had multiple conversations with members throughout the state who have actually confronted some of the people on their property stealing large amounts. It takes quite a few boxes of peaches before you hit that $100 or $150 mark. In a lot of ways, these are organized. And one of the things that we are seeing is the U-Pick operations being targeted by people who have become familiar with the property. They know the access points. They know when the agriculturalist is going to be present. And in one case in particular in West Salem, three rows of peaches were cleaned out over one evening. So obviously finding exactly where that dollar threshold is an important piece, and through a lot of discussion with Legislative Council and Representative Smith, we came to an arrival of $150. So with that, I'll conclude my testimony and hand it off to the other people on the panel.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, members of the committee. I'm Josh Zielinski from Salem, Oregon. Alpha Nursery is located in northeast Salem. It's my family's business. I just want to thank Representative Jefferson Smith for sponsoring this bill, and my representative, Brian Clem, for his work in introducing it. Jeff Stone of the OAN asked me to provide testimony as a victim of agriculture theft. Our nursery has repeatedly been robbed of plant material, more often than not by repeat offenders. One particular incident that highlights the extent that agriculture theft can get to in the nursery probably happened about, I think it was three summers ago. A fellow from the Bend or Redmond area was caught by the police in the nursery after a neighbor called, and he had night vision goggles on and was actually organizing orders for his customers and putting them in his van. Basically, he's caught red-handed, and when the police asked if we wanted to press charges, he said yes, and he was actually out of jail before the sheriff that was on duty shift was over, so about 2 hours. I might also add that this particular guy had 10 prior warrants out for his arrest, and he's no show in court, and 3 weeks later his business is still operating in the Redmond area. Anyway, we estimated that between this incident and others that were strangely similar, including, you know, tire tracks and things like that, he might have made off with about $20,000 worth of plants over the course of the year. Other problems that come along with the loss of plants, we're unable to fulfill orders with product that can take several years to produce. Sometimes there's damage to the property involved, cutting fences, cutting cables, damage to other plant material trying to get to what they want, what their target is. Over the past probably 10 years, we've had to invest tens of thousands of dollars in security measures such as fences, cameras, even a nighttime security patrol. The punishment for agriculture crime needs to be stepped up. I think the bill HB 3490 is just what is needed to help protect our business. Thank you for your time.
Chair Roblin, my name is Kathy LeCompte. I chair the Government Relations Committee for the Oregon Association of Nurseries. You have my written testimony before you today, so I'm just going to summarize that quickly. It's a beautiful sunny day. You probably are anxious to get out to it. Our nurseries are unique to some agricultural commodities in that we farm right next to urban neighbors in a good many cases. In some cases, some of our nurseries actually farm inside city limits. We are attractive targets, and some of our members are hit repeatedly. My own nursery was victimized a few years ago when the thief decided to take one of our tractors, drive it through the nursery, damaging the material, and then smashing the irrigation pipe as they went. When we called the sheriff's office to report the theft, they told us that they were aware of a ring in the area and that the thief had taken the tractor long ago. They'd never find it, and they never even came out. We went to the field and simply followed the tire tracks and found the tractor ourselves. The truth is, the sheriffs are simply too busy to follow up on every event, and many of our nurseries don't even bother to report some of them. One of our nurseries, Countryside Nursery, farms in the Wilsonville area. They were hit so many times that they finally had to put up a very expensive fence, very expensive camera equipment, and ultimately were on the verge of not even farming in that area, just getting rid of that piece of property because it was simply too attractive a target. So you can read the rest of my comments, and I'd be happy to answer any questions if you have any. I do want to highlight, it's not just a $150 crime. Many of us are facing repeated crimes in the thousands or even tens of thousands of dollars.
So before Jeff, Representative Berger, we take that.
Yeah, I wonder if you boy, do I believe you. and I can see that the problem here, I guess, as from a consumer point of view, where are they selling this so you know if you're buying hot peaches or whatever. And I don't mean to make light of it because it is a serious crime issue and I really like this bill, but what's the market for these stolen goods? And
it's all over the board. As Josh was saying, his theft where they found the guy with the night vision goggles. He was actually filling orders that he'd already taken for a customer in Central Oregon. Just didn't bother to grow or buy the material. He helped himself to the Alpha Nursery loading yard instead. In the case of my tractor, it was just kids joyriding, so they didn't have any intention of selling it. They just stole it to wreck it, essentially. In other cases, it's things like fans or irrigation pipe where it's sold to metal dealers for quick cash. So there's a variety of circumstances.
And, Representative Berger, there is an assumption, obviously, that we have made regarding theft in two bills that we've introduced and worked on this session, the metal theft being one and this agricultural theft. The points of entry to the market are very different. In metal theft, you actually have a recycler where you can identify those points of entry back into the marketplace. For a lot of agricultural products, that's just not the case. But when you see a large volume of fruit disappearing, you can draw a conclusion fairly easily that those are not being canned at somebody's house over the weekend. Our assumption from the Farm Bureau is that a lot of those commodities that are fruit-based are being resold at farmers' markets over the weekend.
Thank you. Any other question before we move to Jeff? Jeff.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, Jeff Stone, Oregon Association of Nurseries. I'm pleased that my members were here today. And I also want to just state for the record what this bill is not. It is not about punishing the kid who goes onto a farm and steals two peaches and wonders if old man Gilliam is going to shoot him, as they walk out run from the farm. So I want to make sure that we're clear about the fact that this is something that's an organized fashion, and a lot of our nurseries, as Kathy LeCompte mentioned, don't even report the crime because they know their sheriffs or their law enforcement come out to their nurseries anyway because they're in customers. And It's just not prosecuted. So we think that this bill is measured. We appreciate the support of Jefferson Smith, Representative Smith, in getting this bill before you today. And so I just urge you to strongly consider the measure, and thank you.
Thank you. Representative Berger.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, regardless of the of this bill, I think I've learned, I'm going to the Saturday market tomorrow, to ask, you know, are you representing some farm before I buy something like off the truck? Because if this is truly an issue, then the consumer needs to be aware that you could be buying essentially stolen goods, and that's not right for anybody. I'm going to start noticing the signs there, what the farm is they represent, and make sure that they actually grew it or purchased it legitimately from the farmers.
Any further questions for this group? Thank you all for being here. Very much appreciated. Is there anyone else that was wishing to speak to House Bill 3490? We don't have all the necessary paperwork for this bill yet, but we expect to get it soon. So we're going to close our public hearing on House Bill 3490, and as soon as we get the materials, we will reschedule. But I think it's a good bill. Let's see. No more representatives out there.
Do we have somebody representing the House?
Okay. I'm going to do this one to get some people out of here so they don't have to stay. 2867. I'm going to open a work session on 2867. And the purpose of this work session is really just to look at the Dash 5 amendments and then, I think, put them into the bill and then move the bill out. We don't have all the other information we need, so we're not going to go any further than that. But do you want to come and talk about the Dash 5s? Because we don't have, I think, the res of the FIS, do we? And you can give a short explanation.
Yes, I'll give a short explanation. Thank you, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. House Bill 2867. At this point, we have a revenue statement showing no revenue impact. We are checking to see if they have produced the fiscal, but the Dash 5 just came in, and I doubt that's the case. You have already seen this bill. The original measure deals with requiring contracting agencies before entering into a public contract to establish measurable standards to assess the quality of the contractor's performance and clear consequences for failing to meet those standards. And there's more specific detail in the SMS. There is a Dash 5 amendment that is now available. 2867-5 replaces the original measure. Among its provisions, it excludes cities or counties that have a population of not more than 15,000, community colleges that enroll not more than 1,000 full-time equivalent students, and special districts from coverage of the measure. It increases the coverage threshold over the base original bill from $25,000 to $150,000, makes numerous other changes, which I believe the proponents of the bill will explain.
And so I just want to have a quick explanation of what it is, and then I think we'll move the Dash 5s in, and then because we don't have the fiscal, we'll set it over until we find the information. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair, to the committee. I will be quick. I think that the analysis, we in these Dash 5s, the Dash 5s have changed dramatically from the first version of the bill. We've been really working off amendments for a while, and these are still a significant change from the Dash 4 amendments. I think that the exemptions is one change that were put into this bill to make sure that we were taking into consideration smaller contracting agencies. Another piece of this bill that is a change from the Dash 4 amendments, which were the ones that we really talked about at the last hearing, is that one of the issues that was raised was what if the contracting agency, especially for state government, don't have the position authority to hire staff, although it's cheaper to do the work in-house. But they don't actually have the ability to hire the staff to do the work in-house. And we created a process in this bill with working with state agencies to ensure that that information is tracked. So if we are spending more on contracts, than we would be if the work was provided in-house, that we're tracking that information and the information is given back to the governor and to the legislature for them to make the appropriate decision about how to proceed. And so that's another change in the Dash 5 amendments. And then there's a lot of, you know, technical fixes to clarify language, to make sure that the intent is clear throughout the bill. And those are, I mean, beyond the kind of significant changes around the exemptions and the additional staff, the rest of the changes are more technical in nature to make sure that the bill is clear and that people have a, you know, a clear understanding of what the intention of the bill is.
Thank you very much. Any questions of the Dash 5? Yes.
Mr. Chair, it's my first look. They're large. I don't even, haven't even read them enough to know questions.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. So that people know, we had another work session where we talked about this. There may be other things that we look at. I've talked to people if it goes to where it goes. We don't know. I expect it to have a fiscal, so I expect that it's going to be in need of Ways and Means referral by the time it gets there. There may be some other things as people go on to look at. But right now, I would like to put the Dash 5s, and so I'll take a motion for that. So that forces them to really look at them when the next part, yes.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 5 amendments dated 51409 into House Bill 2867.
Representative Edwards moves that we adopt the Dash 5 amendments to House Bill, make sure I get all these right, 2867. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, any objection? So moved. So the Dash 5s are now part of this bill, or it really is the bill now. And we're going to close our work session on 2867. And we'll probably bring it back on Wednesday with a public hearing as well, because some people would like to testify. So that's what we'll do. Thank you very much. Another announcement, House, and I'm sure if I've done this, House Bill 3401, again, don't have all the pieces of stuff we need, so we're going to move House Bill 3401 to Monday. So 3401 is moved off. Yep. We've already done that one. Already moved. We're checking on a date on the 3004, if it's going to be Monday or Wednesday, depending on the where we put it.
We're slowly getting the room emptied out, Mr. Chair.
Pardon?
We're getting the room emptied out. We're clearing the
room. Clearing the room, letting people go.
It's getting cooler in here.
We can go home.
It's Wednesday.
So 3004 will be held over to Wednesday. Is that the right one? Yeah.
That's correct.
So we're now going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3483. We'll have a short explanation by our administrator.
Thank you, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. House Bill 3483 creates the Wage Option Program, changes the name of the Oregon's Jobs Plus Unemployment Wage Fund to the Wage Option Unemployment Wage Fund, transfers remaining available monies from the Oregon's Jobs Individual Education Account to the Oregon Student Assistance Commission, funds the Wage Option Program by diverting a portion of unemployment insurance taxes each calendar quarter to the Wage Option Unemployment Wage Fund, limits program eligibility, declares an emergency effective on passage. Proponents generally assert that House Bill 3483 would provide greater efficiency in the use of trust fund monies, provide a flexible opportunity for primarily lower income workers who are unemployed and considered likely to exhaust their unemployment claims without securing employment to receive on-the-job training in the early weeks of an unemployment claim, and does so without cost to either the Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund or the State General Fund.
Thank you very much. Representative Girard,
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We can ask you questions. Thank you. My name is Representative Girard, District 56, Southern Klamath County. And, Mr. Chair, thank you for hearing this bill today. We appreciate it. The bill focuses on lower-income citizens who need assistance early in an unemployment claim to find new employment. We certainly have a lot of folks in Oregon in that situation right now. It provides full-time, on-the-job training that keeps claimants whole and working. It gives a claimant a paycheck and a full-time job rather than just a claim check. At the most, it would pay about 65% of the former wage. The bill calls upon resources we already have in the form of employer tax payments and diverts them from the UI Trust Fund to a wage option fund. It creates provisions that directs the Employment Department to manage the program in such a way as to assure no net cost to the trust fund. It is a more effective and efficient use of what would otherwise be trust fund dollars paid for claims without jobs. The wage option bill puts innovative employers together with claimants eager for retaining and finding a job. So I would urge my committee members to give this bill a courtesy look, give the unemployed an opportunity to remain whole through training and employment. And Mark Kane from my district is here to make the official bill presentation and to answer your questions.
Thank you. Mr. Kane.
Chairman Roblin and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify before you this afternoon. And a special thanks to Representative Garrard for stepping up to make House Bill 3483, the wage option bill, one of his priority bills this session. Each one of you knows a relative, a neighbor, or a friend that's unemployed. We all know that we are in a crisis. The statistics and the stories of the pain of unemployment are in the newspaper every day. I was pleased to read in my local paper yesterday morning that Senate President Courtney has introduced Senate Bill 4, aimed at creating up to 5,000 new jobs before the end of the year. The need is recognized, and the approach recognizes the value of on-the-job training, which is also the focus of the wage option bill, House Bill 3483, that we're hearing today. We may take different approaches to fund on-the-job training, but both approaches get the job done. We all agree that we're in a crisis. It's time to get over the politics and take many steps necessary to get people employed. Do we participate in a politics of cynicism, or do we participate in a politics of hope? It is the primary aim of the wage option proposal to keep people whole. There are not many low-income workers who can remain whole while they are collecting an unemployment claim check valued at 65% of their former wage. How many of you can continue to pay your mortgage and the family bills with 35% less to work with? And the crisis grows far worse when that benefit comes to an end and the claimant still does not have a job. The wage option provides you an opportunity to give lower income claimants most likely to exhaust their claims, employment and training to keep them whole. It focuses on those most at risk and places them on an even playing field with those who are more likely to be hired. Further, it provides an opportunity for retraining and an occupational change that is responsive to today's needs of industry. When you think of the spectrum of those on unemployment, it might look like this. I'm holding up a yardstick, if you will. People on unemployment. A subset of that, a lot of people who are exhausting their claims without finding employment. A subset of that, low-income people who are exhausting their claims without finding employment. This is the group at risk that we're trying to focus this bill on. Aren't employers going to hire these people anyway, you may ask? Those on the low-income and likely to exhaust side of the spectrum will be the last to be rehired, and likely the most in need of training. Those on the other side of the spectrum will be hired first. They are also the most likely to be able to find work on their own, and their skills are already more diverse. You can level the playing field and move those most at risk back into employment early in their claims. These participants will avoid that risk of ending their claim without finding a job. They will avoid the risk of falling into expensive state and federally funded safety nets, many of which are disappearing in the face of other budgetary issues we all face today. When I discussed this with James Sager of the governor's office in December, he understood the need for jobs and the skills training, but questioned, how can we do this when no one is hiring? That evening, I flew back to Klamath Falls, reading an article about Harry and David's in the Air West magazine. It was a two-page story about how Harry and David, when the country faced unemployment of 18% in 1935, changed course of their business, and instead of closing their orchards, picked the pears and put them into 6,000 gift boxes. Well, you know the rest of the story, and it became Oregon's largest corporation. Then I read a publication titled Around the State, which comes out weekly. It lists companies' openings and expansions, and it lists companies that are closing and cutting back. That week, there were 27 listings. 16 were about expansions and cutback and expansions, and the others, 11, were about cutbacks. Granted, the closures were frequently bigger than the openings, but the positive ratio of more openings than expansions remains the same almost every week in that publication. The point is that businesses in crisis survive on ingenuity and innovation, just as Harry and David did in 1935. And when we are innovative and we need to train workers for new tasks on the job, this is the bill that can help us do that. It supports those innovative businesses who are willing to hire those most in need of new training and provides the assistance they need to fund that new training requirement. You can make this a win-win for Oregon. The most significant feature of the bill is that it provides jobs and training to claimants without spending any more than we would otherwise spend simply sending benefit checks to claimants without jobs. You have the opportunity to claim a pay, to give a claimant a paycheck and a job, not just a claim check. Further, there's no request to allocate one general fund dollar. It can all be done when you authorize a diversion of the UI trust fund to be spent on the same claimants who would otherwise receive a benefit check coming from the trust fund. I provided each of you with a set of analysis sheets that explain how the costs are no different. Why more than one sheet? Because many of the factors, such as the value of the average claim or the number of weeks of the average claim, are moving targets. They change from month to month. The bill incorporates provisions for the program that flex with those changes and remain no more costly than the cost of checks to non-participants. And I'll walk you through this quickly if you like. You all have one of these in your packet. The first sheet is the standard scenario, comparison of what it costs us for a claim, and then the column next to that, what it would cost to put that same claimant in a training program. And we always try to balance those costs. Now what happens is we've made some assumptions that are shown at the bottom. But they're simply that. They're assumptions. And we always get, or at least we've always gotten in previous sessions, in long arguments over how accurate these are. Well, they aren't accurate. They're simply projections. And so we show you here, well, what happens with this bill when a number changes? And so in scenario one, you can see that, okay, the primary factor has changed. So we adjust another part of the assumption so that the training term gets shorter and the two programs rebalance at no extra cost. In this next scenario, you see that we've taken that main factor, the average benefit per participant's value, and we used a number that the department actually used last session when we discussed a similar bill. And we can show you how we can adjust the term of training and the wage to make this rebalance so that there's no cost. And lastly, a scenario, number three, where we take out some of the credit that we provided on the training side, because the employment department objected, or at least one of their staff members did, that we should be taking that credit. So we show you how we take that out, and we can rebalance it so it has no additional cost. The point is that the directive of the bill is to the department, and it shows them how they can manage the factors that are available to them to make this cost-free. And when you can't manage this to provide the adequate term, then you simply don't implement. It's as simple as that. The most significant The Employment Department does not always agree with the numbers at any given time, but the mandate of the bill is to have the department manage the numbers just as it's demonstrated on the analysis sheets. There's also an attachment which explains this 41-page bill and 10 bolded statements, which all of you have received over the past weeks, and you have it in front of you, and I'm not going to read it to you. Okay. I think Jerry did a pretty good job with that. You have watched me persistently work diligently for three sessions now advancing this concept. Last session, Representative Witt showed support and has since helped coach me in moving and developing this bill. This session, Representative Riley said to me, "You've finally made some progress." Representative Riley also made a suggestion for an improvement, which is included in the Dash 1 amendment, is to allow claimants more paid time to look for another job when the training employer is unable to commit to ongoing employment. Representative Freeman pointed out that the best thing about this type of program, on-the-job training, is that more often than not, you know where the trainee is going to go to work. They're already there. You don't need to worry that you have trained too many and where they might be placed. Chairman Roebling, I thank you for your encouragement at the beginning of this session when we agreed, like it or not, today's economy may be the perfect storm for this bill. You complimented my persistence and gave me hope that this year, when it's needed more than ever, we can pass a bill that will protect future unemployment claimants who are most at risk from having to face long-term unemployment and will keep them whole. I have received both support and criticism from both sides of the aisle, but you have heard it said elsewhere before and from me earlier today. Do we participate in a politics of cynicism, or do we participate in a politics of hope? Other supporters, AOI, has made this proposal part of their legislative agenda this year, and I believe they may be here to make a statement. The Chamber of Commerce has highlighted the program in their recent publication to members and has encouraged member support, as AOI did today in their leading issues publication. You have also received from the Oregon Rehabilitation Association a letter of support that explains the value for their nonprofit members. It speaks not only for their members, but for all similar agencies that operate on relatively fragile budgets and who use wage subsidies to not only train employees, but enhance their ability to expand their services, many of which are publicly funded. Thank you for the opportunity to make the presentation. I hope you'll take this opportunity to use public funds more effectively and efficiently and give the courtesy to the people of the state of Oregon to use those funds to stay whole, to get a paycheck, not a claim check. Thanks.
Any questions for this witness? Thank you again.
All right.
So we do have Steve Lanning and George Ostertag and Tom Byerly. You want to come on up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Steve Lanning with the Oregon AFL-CIO. We continue to oppose any further diversion of the Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund for the purpose of resurrecting the UI-related Jobs Plus program. A few changes made in this compared to the former Jobs Plus program include capping the placement costs, limiting business application paperwork, and changing the name of the program to Wage Option, but it doesn't change the past 10 years of experience with this program. Our opposition to the latest version of Wage Option is based on 6 points, and I'm not going to go over all 6 points in detail. I think my written testimony does that, but I want to mention a couple of them. And the first one is that the Wage Option program doesn't meet the 9 UI diversion principles adopted May 9th, 2006 by the Task Force on Unemployment Insurance and Workforce Training. And I've listed the 9 principles. I have an attachment which shows them and also shows the members of the task force as well. Jobs Plus program hasn't proven to be a cost-effective use of the unemployment insurance funds. The Employment Department reports that the Jobs Plus program spent $1.13 to $1.51 in UI funds for recipients for every dollar in basic UI funds that was spent on non-Jobs Plus claimants. So the program is more expensive per placement. and it's based on 10 years of experience, and we got that information from the Employment Department. And the last point I want to point out to you, or want to make to you, is that any further diversions of the UI Trust Fund would draw the fund down even further, and it could result in higher UI payroll taxes for employers. Thank you for the time, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Tom Byerly. I'm the administrator for the Unemployment Insurance Division of the Employment Department. We're here to offer some brief testimony on this bill. We believe that any concept that would help people get back to work is worthy of discussion. However, we see some costs associated with this particular concept that I brought George Ostertag, one of our policy analysts, along to explain, so I'll turn it over to George.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is George Ostertag. I'm an analyst with the Oregon Employment Department. I won't read my testimony, but just make a few points. First, on the fiscal impact statement does show a significant cost to the trust fund in the end, as a net cost. The proposal that this bill as it's written would divert approximately $37.8 million a biennium from the trust fund into the wage option fund. And what we, that amount of money would provide jobs for approximately 8,000 people a biennium when fully implemented. In the first biennium, it would probably be 2,200, about a quarter of that, because the actual program would start in the last 6 months of next biennium. There is a significant administration cost to run the program. Between, you know, it's, when fully implemented, almost $3 million. Next biennium would be about $1.2 million. The actual benefits offset isn't that large. What we did is we went and looked at the actual program at Jobs Plus, and just for low-wage people, tried to compare the cost of the people in the Jobs Plus program and the low-wage workers who are not in Jobs Plus, and we compared their total UI benefit cost and their wage option subsidy, added them together. The actual benefit savings for people who are in Jobs Plus was not large. It was less than $100 a person, and then in addition to that, you'd have to pay the extra, you know, $1,500 or so for the actual subsidy. So that the actual net cost per person was significant, which would make it very difficult within the constraints of the bill to actually design a program which would be cost neutral on the trust fund. So the way we look at it, it looks like the cost of the trust fund would be over $30 million each biennium. And that concludes. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to take them.
Any questions for these witnesses? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr.
Is there a Mr. Reed that would like to testify, or anyone else in the room that is here to testify on this bill? Seeing no one, we're going to close our public hearing on House Bill 3483, and we're going to open. We're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3450. We'll have a short explanation of our administrator.
Thank you, Chair Roblin. House Bill 3450 prohibits title transfer of a single-family dwelling or multi-family housing containing a carbon monoxide source unless there are properly functioning carbon monoxide detectors at locations that provide carbon monoxide detection for all sleeping areas. It allows for civil action to recover damages, attorney fees, and costs for violation of the statute. Allows the state fire marshal to adopt rules establishing standards for carbon monoxide detectors, requires landlord in multifamily housing to maintain carbon monoxide detectors in units, and prohibits tampering with install detectors. There are amendments which I believe the proponents will explain with regard to this. The background that brings this bill to us is starts at least with the death of a family of four from carbon monoxide poisoning in Colorado that has resulted in new or pending legislation similar to HB 3450 in Colorado and Washington. Roughly half of the U.S. states regulate carbon monoxide in some manner. According to the Centers for Disease Control, carbon monoxide is the leading cause of accidental poisoning deaths in America. It claims some 500 lives annually and sends another 20,000 people to the emergency room. Oregon seems to get roughly its proportionate share of those things. Last year, four individuals died in Oregon as a result of carbon monoxide poisoning. Most of this happens during the winter, mainly due to the increased use of fuel-burning appliances. Carbon monoxide accumulates rapidly in the blood and bonds with hemoglobin, displacing oxygen that cells need to function. At high concentration levels, carbon monoxide can be fatal in minutes. Its symptoms frequently mimic those of flu, and so it is frequently misdiagnosed.
With that, thank you for being here. We'll have whatever order.
Thank you, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. My name is Keely West. I'm the committee administrator for the House Human Services Committee. I'm here on behalf of Representative Carolyn Tomei, who has herself gone home ill today. Representative Tomei got this bill at the request of the family who lost four members in the state of Colorado. When we first heard this bill before the House Committee on Human Services, there was a great deal of objection to the bill as it was written at the chair's request. I facilitated a work group along with Representative Maurer and Denbrough, worked very closely with stakeholders from the real estate lobby, from the Department of Consumer and Business Services, from the State Fire Marshal's Office. Colin Stacey is here from the family. He worked with the group. We had representatives of the Oregon Home Builders and state fire officials from local communities, all of whom came to participate and work really hard to create amendments that would meet the needs of everyone. The -5 amendments, which are before you and are the recommended amendments, designate the bill as the Lofgren and Zander Memorial Act, define a carbon monoxide source, requires the state fire marshal to establish rules for the installation of carbon monoxide alarms, but does remove the aspect of the original bill that would require the state fire marshal's office to enforce the carbon monoxide alarm section. Instead, that has gone into landlord-tenant law and becomes a part of the habitable location for the purposes of a landlord-tenant agreement. The effective dates vary. The state fire marshal will implement rules so that beginning July 1st, 2010, lease agreements, as they turned over, would then be factored into this process of having to have the carbon monoxide alarms in place. With new construction and the real estate transfer to take place effective April of 2011. That was done that way because DCBS rulemaking process, that allows them to not have to do something extra, basically to put it all into the rulemaking process that they have as an ongoing thing and use national standards that they anticipate will be going into effect anyway. This does have the approval of all the stakeholders who came to the table. We worked very hard to make sure the specific language was what was needed that would keep the fiscal impact as low as possible, provide as much protection as possible. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions. And I have supposed to be watching members of the State Fire Marshal's Office, DCBS, and some other places who are happy to respond by cell phone if you have questions that I cannot answer.
Well, we'll have both of you testify, and then we'll ask questions.
Thank you. My name is Colin Stacey. I'm from Portland, Oregon. First, I'd like to thank the members of the committee for hearing us today and thank Keeley for putting into a concise document all the issues that came in through the work group. And, of course, Carolyn Tomei for sponsoring the bill. I want to speak today both as a professional. I work for an architecture firm. I'm a designer of buildings, so I have some knowledge about mechanical systems and building code, and as a member of a family that lost four members last year. Last Thanksgiving, my brother-in-law, Parker, my sister-in-law, Caroline, and their two children, Owen, age 10, and Sophie, age 8, were staying at a new luxury home in Aspen, Colorado. It was a weekend getaway they had purchased at a charity auction. I spoke with them on Thanksgiving evening, and they were very excited about having this luxurious home for the weekend. After Thanksgiving dinner, they all went to bed in the same room. At some time that night, the room was filled with carbon monoxide. It came from a disconnected PVC pipe in a utility closet that was supposed to be part of a venting system for a gas hot water heater and a snowmelt system. Another family that was coming to the house to join them found their bodies 2 days later. This is a pretty common thing. About a month later, another woman who graduated from the University of Portland, who was from Vancouver, Washington, also died in Denver in an apartment building from a very similar incident. Chair Roblin said, 20,000 people are sent to the emergency room annually. 500 people die in the U.S. Those numbers are often disputed because it's a highly undiagnosed problem. Some experts estimate that the number is actually closer to 50,000 per year because a lot of hospitals don't have the proper equipment to detect it because the symptoms are very much like the flu, stomach ache, nausea, et cetera. From 2000 to 2006, there were 38 deaths in Oregon from carbon monoxide poisoning, according to the Department of Human Services. Last year, there were 291 unintentional poisonings and 4 deaths, according to the Oregon Poison Control Center. In a single week of December in 2006, after severe winter storms, in a single week, there were 5 deaths and over 100 poisoning in the Northwest. It was the largest largest single incidence of carbon monoxide poisoning in history of the country. 3 out of 4 carbon monoxide deaths occur in homes, so this bill is specifically focused on homes. A study reported in the American Journal of Emergency Medicine compared carbon monoxide death rates in cities that had and had not had carbon monoxide alarm legislation. For example, in Chicago, where they did have it, 0.4% of the people who were exposed to carbon monoxide died, or about 1 in 250. In Los Angeles, that number was closer to 15%, or 1 in 7. The issue is, when people start feeling sick, nausea, headache, they often lie down. They go to bed, and they often die from this, because you wouldn't think to go outside and get fresh air. As the chair said, it is the number one cause of accidental poisoning in the United States. We don't have that much time, so I'll try to be quick. In my business, I look at the building codes every day. This wouldn't, from our perspective, would be a very simple thing. There's a lot more safety codes that are a lot more difficult and a lot more expensive to comply with. It seemed like everyone at the work group kind of came to a consensus that it was a reasonable thing, and they supported the measure with various levels of enthusiasm. with that, I would encourage you to pass the bill and also to have a carbon monoxide alarm in your own home. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for either of these witnesses?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Gelser.
Thank you. I just wanted to thank you for bringing this bill. I heard about this bill first a couple of months ago from one of my constituents, who is Carolyn's cousin, Rosemary Eldridge and Peter Eldridge, who are actually friends of our family. So I'm very pleased that you brought this forward and grateful to them for talking to many folks we know about the importance of adding carbon monoxide detectors to our homes. Thank you.
And other questions? Just on a personal note with respect to a tragedy when I was a young child, a person chose this as a route to commit suicide. Another child was a few years older than me and was unsuccessful in the attempt using a car. But it the other side effect with carbon monoxide poisoning is that it can destroy your brain and other functions. And so that person was never the same, and it was a real tragic thing to watch. And I do appreciate the bill. I appreciate the fact that they worked it as hard as they did to get to the amendments that sit before us. And it's the dash fives?
The dash fives. And the fiscal and revenues did come back today. The minimal fiscal and no
okay.
revenue.
Have we got those? Because I haven't seen them yet. That's what I was checking on, too.
Jerry had them, I know.
And he was still looking. Are they over there, too? Oh, good. So we do have both of them. That was the one thing we were checking on right now. That's why he zipped off, because he didn't have it in his book. So we're making sure we have them. We believe we do, and if they're both there, I feel really good that they're there. Okay.
3450. Yeah, I've got the dash.
Okay.
Do you want to move?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Well, sit there if you want, or we're going to go on here. No, we have to go to a work session.
No, we're,
so we're going to close our... Is there anyone else that would like to speak to this bill before we move forward? We're going to close our public hearing on 3450. We're going to open a work session on House Bill 3450. Representative?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill... the Dash 5 amendments be adopted into House Bill 3450.
Representative Berger moves that the Dash 5 amendments be adopted to the House Bill 3450. Yes.
And I'd like to speak to my own amendment, the same comment I made before. I haven't read them.
Okay.
And so I'm just furthering the process here and need more information.
Okay.
Thank you.
So is there any other discussion on the amendments to House Bill 3450? Seeing none... We're going to, they are adopted. So that's the Dash 5 amendments. And we do have the RIS and the FIS on this one. So, Representative Berger, do you want to make a motion to the bill, or do you want...
We are going to move it today.
We can. We can wait. Would you rather wait?
Somebody else is going to have to do it then, because I'm read the Dash 5s.
Okay.
If you want to move it,
I think we're ready. We're getting later in the session. The more we wait, the harder it gets, and I think he'll give us a chance to look them over. I feel comfortable having read them and having heard the testimony. From all the people who were involved in these work groups, they have come back and kind of indicated they may not be totally happy, but they're okay with all of them. So.
Is there a fiscal?
The answer is?
We have a minimal fiscal and a no revenue impact.
Representative Edwards.
Mr. Chair, I move the House Bill 3450 as amended to the floor with due pass recommendation.
And I agree. I don't usually like to do this. I usually like to give a little longer time, and we'll look them over. And with that, any further discussion? Oh, Representative Edwards moves House Bill 3450 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, we'll take a roll call vote.
Representative Gerard?
Aye.
Representative Gelser?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Excused.
Representative Nolan?
Yes.
Representative Reed?
Aye.
Vice Chair Berger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Edwards?
Aye.
Chair Roblin?
Aye. And we will have Representative Tomei carry this bill.
I'll let her know. Thank you very much.
Yep. So we're going to close our work session on House Bill 3450. I'll go to this one. I'll go to 28. We're going to open the work session on 2895. And with that, I think we have some amendments to this bill, so I'm going to let some of the people who are working on 2895 come tell us about their amendments. And we'll give a short explanation by Jerry as well.
Thank you, Chair Roblin. Members of the committee, House Bill 2895 permits the Secretary of State to designate one or more organizations to establish citizen panels to review and create statements of not more than 150 words on each initiated state measure. Requires the Secretary to print those statements in a letter pamphlet that has a number of other provisions that were discussed previously. When you previously heard this bill, you discussed the provisions of the measure, constitutional and legal limitations on restricting the initiative process, concerns about the lack of voter knowledge, the experience with a prior pilot review program in 2008, and the possible perception that perhaps the state would be deemed to be involved in measure advocacy through having review panels. There was a Dash 1 set of amendments. I believe we now have a Dash 2. And I think I'll let the
I think that'd be great.
People
Thank you very much. We're in a work session. We do not have all the paperwork for the Dash 2s, so it can't be moved today, but I would like to get on the record what those are and how they go, and so I'll, with that, please give us an explanation.
Lynn, members of the committee, my name is Megan Perry. I am policy aide to Representative Harker. He would have liked to be here, but he is in another committee right now. We actually moved both the Dash 1. We introduced both the Dash 1s and the Dash 2s. The Dash 2 does replace the Dash 1. It addresses many of the issues. When you first heard this in a public hearing, some of the concerns were the sunset, clause really explicitly stated. Some of the funding issues, we wanted to make sure that that was clear, that it was not going to be up to the state to fund any of this. It was through the organization. But I'm going to let Tyrone and Elliot, who you have seen before, kind of fill in any of the gaps.
Chair Rebel, members of the committee, my name is Tyrone Reitman. I'm from Eugene, Oregon. I'm the co-director of Healthy Democracy Oregon, and I'm going to quickly just provide a summary of the Dash 2 amendments. The goal of the amendments is to align the bill with the original intent of the Citizens Initiative Review pilot legislation. First, the amendments make clear that the Citizens Initiative Review, as proposed, is a one-time pilot, so a sunset provision has been added. Second, the amendments stipulate that the convening organization, not the state, must provide the full funding for the Citizens Initiative Review. Third, specific and rather stringent requirements have been added to mandate that the convening organization running the reviews cannot accept funds from political action committees or corporate or union treasuries. Fourth, the amendments limit the scope of the pilot to a maximum of 3 reviews to be conducted in the 2010 election cycle. And lastly, the amendments clarify several aspects about the review process itself and make sure that the demographics of the randomly selected panelists that are at the heart of the process are objectively selected and clear. The amendments, therefore, seek to ensure both the process is worthy of the public's trust and has no financial impact on the state's budget. Thank you.
Any questions?
I have a question.
Yes, sure. Representative Edwards.
In the rundown, you said they could not receive money from, and you said a couple different sources. You said political action committees or
corporate or union treasuries.
Oh, you did say corporate. Okay. I heard union. I didn't hear corporate. So, okay. Thank you.
Question, Representative Berger.
Two professional mediators or facilitators who have been trained to conduct citizen review panels. Who trains them?
Representative Roblin, Vice Chair Berger, my name is Elliot Schubert. I'm from Portland, Oregon. In answer to your question, Representative Berger, the convening organization would train those moderators. That's at least our intent. As it's stipulated here, it's not specific, but it would need to be trained for that purpose.
Thank you.
Further discussions? Okay. From my perspective, what we will do now is add the Dash 2s. That means that physical can just do the fund analysis. And then we'll look and I'll talk to my committee members and we'll see when we're going to put it up next. So with that.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 2s dated 5-14-09 into House Bill 2895.
Representative Edwards moves the Dash 2s into House Bill, 2895. Is there any discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, so moved. And we're going to close our work session on House Bill 2895. Thank you very much. And we have one bill left, and it should take very little time, and I'm going to hand my gavel over because it's a bill that I have. So. Yep, you can have a chance to explain it.
Opening a public hearing, Mr. Chair, is that okay? And what's the bill number?
3489.
So I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3489. If the administrator would read us a summary of the bill.
Thank you very much, Vice Chair Edwards, and members of the committee. House Bill 3489 has a no revenue impact statement and a minimal fiscal statement.
Thanks.
The measure directs the State Department of Fish and Wildlife to develop a plan for reforming department-operated fish hatcheries on the Oregon coast. It specifies required provisions in the plan, directs the department to complete the plan and submit it to an interim legislative committee related to the Environment and Natural Resources for review on or before October 1, 2010. Declares emergency, effective on passage.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Arne Roblin, representative from House District 9. House Bill 3489 is about taking information we already have, putting it into a report, and having the interim committee look at it, and it has to do with hatcheries. We have a research hatchery at LC that we've been using for a number of years. This is giving us good information about some of the issues that are in this bill. The department has been collecting information on the how our old hatcheries are, what condition they're in. And the goal is to start, from those of us who live on the coast, getting those hatcheries back in the ability to produce and finding out what that's going to cost and what we need to do if we're going to manage for our fish. The issue, I think, that will go along with this but is not really related necessarily related to this bill, there have been studies that indicate that cormorants and other birds are predators for the smolts and the salmon coming down the stream, and it could be as much as 40% of the fish are being eaten. And then on the way back up the streams, our seals and sea lions are the predators that take another 20% of those fish. And so if we're really trying to make sure that our natural fish make it and our other fish make it, we've either got to limit on the site of predators or produce so that the chances of eating the natural fish are less because there's enough hatchery fish that are going out. Not necessarily good solutions, but we know that hatcheries have had impacts on our streams, and the best way to take care of that is to look at the research we have and look at the information we have and help make good decisions about whether we start them up and how we take care of those things which have been problems in the past. Our new hatchery at LC is proving, I believe, to give us great information about how to manage and do those things. And it's as the bill is written right now, and you'll hear us about some Dash 1 amendments, which we don't have the physical and the other document we need, this bill we would like to send without those. We do see, understand part of that, and as long as they don't cause it to cost anything. This bill, as it is written, has no physical. That's a good thing in this particular era. I'm not convinced that the Dash 1s won't. So those of us, and Representative Krieger and I have been working on this bill, believe that if the department can do with their resources, just put the information together and get it to the interim, we'll have some better information to make good decisions on what we're going to do with hatcheries in the future. So that's the bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Please.
Chair Edwards, member of the committee, my name is Bruce McIntosh, and I'm the Deputy Fish Division Administrator for the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. Thanks for the opportunity to provide some comments on House Bill 3489. As Representative Roblin described, the bill directs the department to review existing information on the operation of the 9 department-owned hatcheries in the Oregon coast. It calls for reviewing these hatcheries in relationship to a number of things. I'll talk about those briefly. Brood stock and production strategies. So how many fish we produce, what kind of fish we produce, and how do we produce them so that we minimize impacts on naturally produced fish and the environment. Infrastructure enhancement. So getting at some of the things that Representative Roblin discussed, we're looking at hatcheries that are anywhere from 50 to almost 100 years old. So in many cases, there are new things you would do in the 21st century to make these operate more effectively. In terms of pollution management, we have very effective pollution abatement plans in place. We operate under permits from DEQ and are in 100% compliance on that. But as most of you know, in terms of pollution, there's always work to do. Fish disease. You know, anytime you raise products, whether it's agricultural crops or livestock or fish, there's always issues of disease. We have very strong policies in place and approaches to deal with that. But again, there's always more you can do on that front. And then finally, deferred maintenance. As I said, many of these hatcheries are very old. Previous legislatures have provided funds to deal with deferred maintenance, and through those funds and even the Go Oregon program, we're chipping away at those things. But as time goes by, there's more to deal with. From our perspective, the legislation would provide some important new information as we synthesize the work we've done and provide the necessary framework to really bring these programs into the 21st century. Similar reviews to this have been occurring across the Pacific Northwest really over the last decade. They've been focused in the Columbia River Basin and Puget Sound. Those have been very beneficial to the region and department, and we think this would complement that. As Representative Roblin said, the plan will be developed with existing information with our current staff and be submitted, I believe it's in October of 2010, to an interim committee. From the department's perspective, there's a minimal fiscal associated with this, so we view this as a good thing. So with that, I'll conclude my testimony. If there's any questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Thank you, Bruce. Joe?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Joe Rollator. I'm here today representing Oregon Guides and Packers. I also represent Desert Springs Trout Farm, which is a large private aquaculture firm in eastern Oregon, which grows trout, obviously. I've been working with Representative Krieger and Chair Roblin on this bill because I think that the coastal hatcheries have kind of been neglected in all these reviews that we've been doing over the last decade or so. The Hatchery Scientific Review Group report that just came out in April, it's a very good report. It took 3 years of a bunch of scientists to write. It's got some good structure in it. It's got some things that we can use in our coastal hatcheries. One of the things that we know, we found out about 10 years or so ago, is that we needed to pay attention to the genetics of the fish that we were producing in the hatchery so that they wouldn't have an adverse effect on the wild fish and so that they would return and be a contributor to fisheries. But there's a big question right now. There's, in some cases, there's a high loss of these wild-captured brood stock. In other words, we go out and catch these fish a lot of times with a hook and line and then take them into the hatchery and keep them until they're ready to be spawned. And in some cases, a very high mortality rate on those fish. And we're very concerned about that. But in other cases, the mortality rate is almost nothing. Now, is that because of the infrastructure? Is it because of the way the fish are captured or what? And we'd like to know that so that we can preserve that very valuable wild broodstock. Additionally, the bill asks for a review of the infrastructure and hatchery operations to make sure, as it points out in the Hatchery Scientific Review Group study, that hatcheries have a minimum effect on their watersheds and on the things that live in those watersheds. And additionally, the deferred maintenance. As Bruce said, there's a lot of maintenance that has to be done. We've sort of chipped away at the system, but a lot of the stimulus money that was used both from the state stimulus and the Fed stimulus didn't take the very first things on the maintenance list. It took some things out of the middle. So we've suggested that this maintenance needs to be reorganized. I also believe that in view of the fact of the recent discussions about the Columbia in Representative Breed's committee, we all recognize that if we're going to have fisheries in the future, we need to produce wild hatchery fish, and those hatchery fish have to be in work in harmony with the wild fish, and that we're going to have to come back to this legislature as fishermen in the future and say, this is what we think needs to be done to our hatcheries, and this is how we want to pay for it. I think this is a first step on the coastal hatcheries, which are a little bit different animal than the Columbia hatcheries. They're really the hatcheries that provide the fisheries for us coastal fishermen that fish in these rivers. So thank you very much.
Representative Gard.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. There are certainly people
Chair Roblin and Representative Krieger, who are much more knowledgeable on the subject of hatcheries than I. However, I am more than alarmed at some of the information that's coming into my office in regards to pollution and various other problems in the hatcheries. So I really support this bill, and I think it's a good bill, and it's a good first step.
Representative Berger?
Yeah, the hour is late. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So let me comment briefly. In a previous life, 20-some years ago, I made equipment for hatcheries. And I mean, I made fish pumps. I was in charge of the manufacture of them and sold them to hatcheries. And as a result, I went around to a lot of Oregon hatcheries. And I went to some in Idaho, and I saw the operation, and I talked to the managers. And it was pretty clear to me then, that was 20 years ago, this ain't going to pack it. We had deep, abiding problems in this system. I'm a little dismayed to hear now. And frankly, when I first came in, I was happy to see the ALCE, you know, going forward as people saying, we've got to look at this differently. We've got to find different models and see what's going to work and what isn't. So here we are. Again, saying, let's look at this differently, let's keep reviewing and see if we can get there. My only question about this bill is, why do we need a bill? because there's an awful lot at stake. It isn't just a bunch of fishermen. It's fish runs, and I guess I'm a little discouraged that even 20 years later, we aren't farther along in understanding where these fish go, what happens to them, what we're doing right, what we're doing wrong, and that we have an old infrastructure. I bet the equipment that those fish pumps, I bet I could find some still in use in this state. Of course, they were made to last, but you get my point.
I just want to speak to the part about why do we need the bill, and I guess it's becoming one of my mantras lately, and that is that we have two branches. We have the executive and we have the legislative. We have the judicial too, but right now executive and the... And so we sit here as the legislative, and sometimes we look around and we look at the executive branch, and they've made choices to go and do certain things. And there are times when I think the legislative branch has to say, we understand that you as a commission have the right to choose how to use all the people and do things, but there are times when we think things have been neglected and we think it's a higher priority. And so what I'm saying in this bill, along with I think Representative Krieger, is that this is a priority that we think, at least from legislators on the coast, that's been overlooked for a long time. And they have had the opportunity to do this at any time they wished. They have not chosen to. And so this is the legislative branch saying to the executive branch, at least part of your time is going to be spent on this priority. So that would be the answer to me.
I have a question for Representative Roblin. Can we assume that since the bill says on line 5, 4 and 5, a plan to reform operation of department-operated fish hatcheries on the Oregon coast, well, since no hatchery is literally on the coast, or there may be a few that are close to the coast. We're talking about coastal streams, and that does not, I'm assuming that does not include the Columbia River system. Can you clarify which ones the intent is to...
Yeah, and then I'll let them tell the exact names of the ones, but there has been a really good study on the Columbia cooperative studies, so those hatcheries, we kind of know that pretty well already. So that one is taken off there. There's other studies that are happening on the Klamath down below, and there's federal stuff. There's a lot of stuff happening down there. And I don't think that one, that's kind of ends up as a California river. So the issue, and there's a number of them, I think there's 11.
Nine.
Okay. There are 9 hatcheries that would make up the coastal hatcheries. And if you want to know the exact ones, he could tell you which ones they are.
Could you share with us the list, and then Representative Berger has a
question? I
just
want to hear the list.
Okay.
Chair Edwards, members of the committee, I'm glad I wrote these down before I came over. We have 33 hatcheries, so I don't carry them around the top of my head. But going from north to south, then the Halem, the Trask, Cedar Creek, Salmon River, the ALCE, Rock Creek, Bandon, Elk River, and Butte Falls.
So it is, as you spoke, it's out of the Columbia Coastal okay. Systems.
So none on the Umpqua? That's
Rock Creek's on the Umpqua.
Oh, yes, right. Mm-hmm. Rock Creek. Okay, yeah. It's okay. Any other questions for the panel? Thank you.
Thank you.
And as the chair makes his way back up here, we'll call up David Moskowitz and Jim Welsh.
Chair Roblin and committee members, Jim Welsh here representing Oregon Cattlemen and Oregon State Grange. And we have very solid feelings about strong hatcheries in Oregon. And you probably wonder, well, what is this? Someone here, and there isn't any other agriculture entities here ready to line up and give testimony on this, but we firmly believe that, you know, fisheries is natural resources, and we are developing are trying to redevelop maybe a better relationship with our fisheries, with our natural resource partners, and supporting them here. It really supports the economy, we believe, in the state too, because we think the hatcheries and a healthy hatchery system will definitely bring dollars to smaller communities, not only in the coast, but you have to remember that solid fisheries, you know, those streams go inland. So our inland ranchers and farmers benefit from good fisheries. There's no doubt about it. It takes that focus off of all the negative things that maybe are only perception, because we've started to address this over 20 years ago, riparian along the on the streams and all sorts of other things. Senate Bill 1010 back in the early 90s that addressed a lot of these water quality issues and fishery issues, the salmon plan, which I was very familiar with in the 90s. So those things are very important to my clients. And this bill, we believe, and we gave testimony when it was in the other committee, in Chair Clem's committee also. And so we are favorable, definitely, and support this and like to see it go forward. We also realize the challenges on the financing side. So, you know, it's a tough time, but it's a good issue. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. My name is David Moskowitz, and I'm here today on behalf of the Native Fish Society and the Oregon Council of Trout Unlimited. And we're speaking in support of House Bill 3489. We testified in support of its predecessor, House Bill 3078. We believe it's a good bill. Regarding the questions of scope, clearly a focus on the coast would capture some of the work that's been done in the Columbia Basin by federal, state, tribal and regional entities. We would like to see, though, something in the bill that asks the department to at least incorporate by reference all of that good work, and we think that's very important because there's been some very important work that's been done. And we would like to point out that the Columbia is a coastal river, despite thoughts to the contrary. This plan, the plan that we've asked the department to come up with, we're trying to figure out the future for both hatchery fish and for wild fish that they're meant to either replace as mitigation or to perhaps help in restoration. So it's going to be very important that the plan looks at some of the elements that are important to wild fish productivity. And our organizations had put forward the Dash 1 amendments, and we've asked those not to interfere with moving this bill forward because we do feel very strongly about it. I would like to just call your attention to, in the bill on page 8, which is subsection 1, sub 2A, in terms of brood stock and production management strategies, there is Dash 1 amendments, there is a suggestion that adds a clause or a sentence behind that those four words, and we think that's an important element because it captures all of the elements that make wild fish so productive. And wild fish are pretty incredible because they come from Oregon's natural hatcheries, which are our rivers and streams throughout the state, and that come from both private lands and public lands. And they're incredibly important. The state needs to continue to make an investment to make those rivers productive, and we need to make sure that our hatchery strategy matches with our wild fish productivity. And I want to point out, I had a handout that it's not a great reproduction, but Trout Unlimited put together a document called a blueprint for hatchery reform in the 21st century, and so I provided a copy for you, and some of the best, most preeminent scientists in the Northwest have really looked at how do you operate hatcheries, and we think there's some really creative things in there. I think they touch on some of the elements that Representative Berger started talking about, and I think it's becoming more and more important and more apparent that we need those, the changes in those hatcheries to deal with how those offspring deal with predation, and just how we kind of condition those hatchery fish. So we think this gives some ideas, hopefully, for everybody. Again, we support this bill, and we appreciate. I'm going to cut it short here because I'm a little nervous because it's the latest I've ever testified before the legislature. So being here late Friday afternoon, thank you very much for your attention, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for these panelists? No. Thank you very much, and thanks for the amendments too. I think those things we can incorporate when we get to the Senate. And I appreciate it. We're just nervous about.
Yep, we're with you.
Physical. Okay, thank you very much.
As you should be, Mr. Chair. as somebody that sits on the Natural Resources Subcommittee, you should be nervous about this.
Yeah. So we're going to close our public hearing on House Bill 3489. Oh, I'm sorry. There's one more person. Thank you, Carter Kearns. Thanks for catching me before I got the gavel down. Would have had to bring you back to the work session.
I'll be brief so you can move along. I'm Carter Kearns from Pendleton. I'm the Commissioner for Eastern Oregon for the Fish and Wildlife. And I'd like to speak in support of the bill. I think it's time that has come for it. I think it's a very good policy move for us to do that. And we need more fish for people to catch in the state of Oregon. I support it 100%. And also want to mention to Representative Girard that my in-laws live in Klamath Falls, so I get down there once in a while. And I've been promised a fishing trip on the Hyde Ranch, so one of these days I'll get down there and do that.
Give me a call. We'll make sure it happens.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Any questions? I just want to say thank you for serving, too, in Oregon and being a part of ODFW.
Thank you.
These boards and commissions, the time and effort put in by people, and those of us who have to travel to Salem know that it's not next door for some of us. And we appreciate people who are willing to put the time in and to be at those meetings and do those things for us.
Well, thank you. It's about a 600-mile round trip, and I'm only one vote among seven, but as our chair will probably tell you, I'm not a wallflower.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. So now we will close our hearing, especially after having that long trip. Not to have had him, it would have been really bad form. So we're going to close our public hearing on House Bill 3489. And one, two, three, there's five of us. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3489.
You need the dash ones?
No dash ones.
No. Okay. Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3489 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Edwards moves House Bill 3489 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Briefly.
Representative
Very
Edwards.
Very briefly. I think it's a good bill. I'm not convinced that we need a bill. I think they should be doing it. But you know what? If that's what it takes to move this forward, then let's get it through.
And to that, I if you go to the hearings for the Fish and Wildlife or Advantage Places, you will realize there are thousands of issues that come to them all the time. And making priorities is always difficult because it's just tough. And I think sometimes it's nice for the legislator or others to say, this is something we think is a priority, put it on your docket. And I think that helps them too. So that's the reason for some of these bills. So any further discussion? Seeing none, we'll take a roll call vote.
Representative Girard?
Aye.
Representative Gelser?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Excuse.
Representative Nolan?
Excused.
Representative Reed?
Aye.
Vice Chair Berger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Edwards?
Aye.
Chair Roland?
Aye. Motion passes, and let's assign Representative Krieger and I to co-carry.
Good choice.
We got through a long agenda today, folks. I appreciate you being here at 4:55, and that we're going to get out early like this. No. So, So again, we did hold two over, which was 3401 to Monday and 3004 to Wednesday, and I just want to remind people of that. And with that, we are going to close our rules hearing for today. Thank you all for being here.
Thank you.
And if you want a piece of chocolate, it's here. It's Friday. I do.